Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello there. Welcome to today's New Books in Education, one of the podcast channels in New Books Network. This is your host, Pengfei Zhao, speaking to you from Gainesville, Florida. Today, I will be talking with Xue Li Wang on her new book, On My Own, The Challenge and Promise of Building Equitable STEM Transfer Pathways. The lack of talented STEM workers has been a national concern in the United States for decades. A lot of the discussions about this issue focus on from kindergarten to the 12th grade, undergraduate, or graduate education. Whereas Xue Li takes us to a much less examined road to look at the transferring pathways from community colleges to four-year universities. In today's interview, you will hear us talk about the educational opportunities that the transfer pathways offer to an entire generation of American youth, and especially those coming from disadvantaged family backgrounds. We will also discuss how these opportunities have been to some degree compromised due to various reasons, and what are some of the things that colleges, universities, communities, and the whole society could do to better support these aspirational students. Now let's turn to Xue Li, the author of On My Own, The Challenge and Promise of Building Equitable STEM Transfer Pathways. Hello, Xue Li. Thanks for joining us today. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Pengfei, for the warm welcome. I'm thrilled to be here.
And also, congratulations on publishing this wonderful book. It's really amazing.
Thank you.
So can you first please introduce yourself to our audience?
Yes, sure. So a little about me. I'm a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis within the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I teach graduate courses involving topics on community colleges, assessment in higher education, and mixed methods research in education. As a researcher, I study college students' learning, their experiences, their pathways, and success, with a particular focus on community colleges and STEM education. Ultimately, I hope that my scholarly agenda advances a unique and insightful understanding of issues of equity along students' pathways to success. And then in that light, I have collaborated with a number of remarkable community and technical colleges on these issues through my National Science Foundation-funded projects. So that's a brief overview of me and some of my work.
Wonderful. Do you want to say a little bit more about how you came to this point of studying this specific area, or like some of the personal stories that have been milestones for you to study here or do this research?
Yeah, speaking of my long-standing interest in transfer, and then in the present time, more specifically on transfer pathways in STEM areas of study, and I had to go back to my time at Ohio State University when I was a graduate student. So I arrived at the larger topic on community college transfer during my time as a doctoral student at Ohio State University, studying in the higher education program there. My interest then was mostly driven by seeing the success of post-transfer students through both the literature I engaged with and many personal encounters with highly successful, kind, and savvy transfer students attending Ohio State University. So that is, I've seen that if community college students make it to the point of transfer, they're as likely to succeed and get their bachelor's degree as students who start out directly at four-year institutions. So on a personal level, this seems really heartening and uplifting, allowing me to see the democratizing function in transfer through the community college pathway and something quite uniquely American. And then on the other hand, the reality is that far too many students beginning at community colleges wanting to transfer don't actually make it to the transfer. So the numbers have been pretty consistent on this. Only around a quarter of students who want to transfer eventually transfer within 6 years. So many of them don't even get to be a part of this post-transfer success story that I've witnessed both as a researcher and as an individual. So thinking about my interest as for STEM transfer pathways in particular, I was first exposed to the narrative that there was a shortage of STEM workforce talent also back then around 2008 when completing my dissertation research on community college transfer student success. So the ways in which two-year colleges were portrayed in the STEM shortage policy narrative was super fascinating but also bothersome because upward transfer as a significant role of two-year colleges was almost invisible in those narratives. All of this really troubled me because if we think about transfer as one of the most democratizing functions in higher education in the United States, and then when we talk about STEM talent at the baccalaureate level, we don't even think about community college transfer as part of the equation. So building equitable transfer pathways in STEM and other areas was not only a growing issue of national concern, but has since been at the heart and soul of my research over the past decade.
Well, that sounds like very fascinating. What I've heard is about this democratizing function of STEM pathways, like STEM transfer pathways, and how like this dream of chasing democratization of the higher education to equalizing the higher education have been motivated you in your pursuit of your career. So I wonder if you could, we have talked a lot, you have to talk a lot about the transferring experience and the successful stories. I wonder if you could, I'm kind of backward, like trying to piggyback a little bit, is to say, like, if you could say a little bit more about the overarching, the general picture of STEM talent shortage in the United States, because I know like this is a growing national concern, but I hope that we could give our audience a broader picture of what's going on there. And also you mentioned, in the policy discourse, there is a lack of presence of the STEM community, like the STEM transferring pathways. So maybe just trying to give our audience a more general picture. So would you like to say more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right in saying that the STEM shortage issue has been gaining a lot of attention at the national level. And in a sense, there has been a lot of investment in resolving the STEM talent shortage issue. However, I think my problem was community and technical colleges have had their share of attention when it comes to this issue. But the truth of the matter is that at least the initial focus on these institutions in resolving STEM shortage at the time when I was a student, this was about 10 years ago, at the time, the initial focus on these institutions was still primarily at the workforce preparation level in terms of the so-called sub-baccalaureate degrees and the so-called mid-skill jobs, implying that students would stop before they ever transferred to earn a bachelor's degree. So even though there were urgent calls to increase the number of students getting bachelor's and graduate degrees in STEM, two-year colleges weren't even part of that conversation. And in that light, if we limit STEM education at the community college to job preparation only at the baccalaureate, at the sub-baccalaureate level only, this leaves out a huge group of talented and motivated students who could transfer in STEM. And this is essentially blocking any potential of upward mobility in terms of their STEM education and career. Plus, the irony is that there have been repeated calls for enriching the diversity of STEM bachelor's degree talent, considering that community colleges enroll more students of color, women, students from low-income families, and first-generation students, and so on, compared to four-year institutions. These two-year community and technical colleges need to be a very intentional part of the solution. And another important thing to point out is that while there have been resources pouring into the STEM workforce shortage issue, this picture is much more complicated for community colleges. In reality, these resources are unequally allocated across higher education, leaving two-year institutions often at a disadvantage in fulfilling their role as an equitable transfer pathway. So these institutions have been consistently under-resourced and underfunded. So even though there are amazingly motivated and resilient students in STEM starting at community colleges who intend to transfer, they may end up with limited institutional support and encounter other challenges, largely owing to the under-resourced nature of community colleges. So all these issues, they really compound to negatively affect the potential of equitable STEM transfer pathways, and these issues must be resolved in order to build more equitable STEM transfer pathways.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for your very detailed and comprehensive explanation. Now I think, you know, after reading the book, I feel like I have a good understanding of why this is important. But after talking with you, after asking these questions, I feel like I have an even better understanding on this. And this is indeed something matters a lot for students, for families, and for, you know, the continuous prosperity of this country. And yes, it's very meaningful. Then what do you hope to achieve in this book?
Well, Pukwe, as you might have remembered, this book is a culminating product of a longitudinal study that I initiated that closely follows STEM transfer aspiring students' journeys on the ground. So with that, my book aims to demonstrate that STEM transfer is by no means a simple or straightforward process. Instead, it is deeply complex and nuanced as students attempt to hold fast to their high aspirations and strong perseverance, and along with their own agency, despite the many obstacles they encountered. And this process is further complicated by disparities and inequities that permeate students' path toward or away from transfer, especially when we think about students of color, women, students with mental health issues or learning disabilities, first-generation students, and those from low-income backgrounds. These students often face the largest hurdles. So I really want to highlight the disparities. They're not the deficits in the students, but disparities created by the system. At the same time, I also argue that the challenges and barriers should not be up to the individual students to resolve. They really, as I mentioned, reflect the inequitable transfer mechanisms in STEM systematically in place and in need of disruption. So in the end, I really hope to explicitly name these mechanisms so we can move toward disrupting them. I outlined all these areas in need of disruption in my book. Also, it is important to mention that in light of what I aim to achieve with this book, I hope to get both community colleges and four-year institutions in the same room, engaging with each other as equal, active, and proactive partners in supporting transfer students writ large. As my book has shown, hopefully, transfer students continue to be deeply impacted by both ends of the process of transfer and articulation. And the reality is that transfer is not a community college concern alone. It takes the entire post-secondary sector to pave the transfer process for students. As a whole, I hope my book will be an informative read for researchers, practitioners, and policymakers, and I hope it offers a holistic and critical approach to break down STEM transfer barriers, along with some actionable steps to do so. Although I laid out a wide range of specific recommendations based on my research findings, none of them are really possible without an equity-centered mind shift and purposeful reflection, which I discussed in detail during my final chapter. So this kind of reflexivity means instructors and practitioners hold themselves and their institutions responsible for enacting practices, policies, and structures that address persistent inequities, bring us all closer to achieving more equitable STEM transfer. That ultimately summarizes what I was hoping to achieve, and I hope I did to some extent.
It sounds like, it sounds like a very comprehensive project, and you're speaking to multiple audiences, and you have this very great aspirations to address these complex issues from multiple dimensions. And I look forward to hearing more details and more of the insightful findings from the book. And with that said, I wonder if we could also say a little bit more about the back of the stage story about the book. Say, you know, one thing that I really appreciate a lot about the book is that you present as a long-term in solid and complex study in a very engaging and a straightforward way. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about this project behind the book?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate your compliments, Pengfei. So this longitudinal mixed methods study is really the whole body of research underlying this book. The project followed a cohort of 1,670 students beginning in STEM programs and courses at three large two-year institutions in the Midwestern state in fall 2014. And we followed the students attending these institutions and onward until fall 2018. During those 4 years, I worked with my incredible research team to collect data from these students through multiple waves of surveys, in-person interviews, and college transcripts to follow their educational and life journeys as they moved either toward or away from the prospect of transfer to a four-year institution. We, more specifically, we administered surveys during three points in time to learn about students' college and life journeys, if they transferred, and what the process was like if they indeed transferred, or the reasons why they didn't transfer. We also collected survey data on other potential scenarios if they didn't transfer in terms of their workforce participation, life obligations, and context, and then all their associated experiences along the way. And then in addition to the survey data, we followed up with three rounds of interviews with a small with a smaller number of students who participated in the survey to learn more deeply about their experiences in ways that survey research wouldn't necessarily allow us to do so. And on top of the in-person interviews and then the survey data, we also used students' college transcripts to help us track their educational journeys and pathways, including transfer and eventual credential completion and such. So all together, these sources of data help us construct a fuller STEM transfer process and to arrive at the kinds of conclusions and implications that I drew through the book.
Well, thanks for sharing. Now looking back, what are some of the challenges of completing this project? It sounds like a super complex and also it's a long-term project.
Yeah, great question. I wouldn't lie. There were a lot of challenges and all good and motivating challenges, of course. And I will say, though, the overall good challenge is to achieve the delicate balance of a rigorous, complex, and authentic study and the amount of careful work and thinking that goes towards that. So as an example, it is really challenging to capture the fluidity and messiness of students' educational intent, their academic pathways, especially in light of the many missions and functions of community colleges. So in order to kind of harness this kind of challenge a little bit, I included all students who were enrolled in STEM programs and courses as first-time students at the three institutions and asked about their educational intent multiple times in multiple ways through the surveys and the in-person interviews. So, for instance, this approach allowed us to account for and potentially tease out the inherent messiness I just talked about around intent to transfer and then transfer in STEM in particular. So my team and I were able, through collecting data this way, we were able to analyze these multiple measures of their intent to determine if our findings were actually sensitive to different ways of asking about their educational intent. This also helped us demonstrate how fluid and evolving educational intent can be for students, along with the underlying reasons behind it. Then in addition, including all students with initial exposure to STEM programs or courses naturally also resulted in a fair concentration on STEM and potential transfer in STEM areas of study. But at the same time, this approach made the study more broadly relevant to transfer in general. So although we included this large group of students in the sense that we were, to begin with, we can say that all students were definitely intending to transfer and intending to transfer in STEM, this approach did help us capture their fluid intent within and outside of STEM. So in this sense, this approach made the findings and implications of the study more applicable to not only transfer in STEM, but transfer in general. So I will say these kinds of challenges, using the example that I shared, inspired me and my team to be very careful with the ways we collected our data and the kinds of the data we collected, and also the multiple ways in which we approached our data analysis in honest, imperfect, but careful ways.
By educational intent, do you mean the intent to transfer or not, or like the intent in a broader sense?
Right. And I would say both. Of course, with the study having a specific focus on transfer, asking directly about students' intent pertaining to transfer specifically is important, but also is part of the larger picture of their aspirations toward other potential types of educational attainment and along with their life goals and such. So we do have very specific survey items asking about intent to transfer, but we also introduce the broader picture, mirroring the wide range of aspirations and intent when it comes to education, career, and life in general.
Can you give us some examples?
Right. One example, talking about the different ways and the good messages around actually just how to ask about intent, right? So in our survey items, we just for transfer alone, we ask about transfer intent loosely defined in three different ways. We ask, at this point, do you intend to transfer to a four-year institution? And we followed up with, if you do intend to transfer, what is the time frame? And then another major item is about sort of a more broad life scheme. For example, do you anticipate completing a bachelor's degree that's kind of encompassing transfer as an inherent part of the equation? And then a third way to gauge transfer intent is through opening up the survey by asking the primary purpose for students to attend this particular two-year institution. Because then if they indicate in transfer to a four-year institution as the primary reason for attending, that's another, a third way of triangulating our findings around transfer intent.
So it sounds like you're trying to really grapple with this very fluid and evolving situation about students' intention to transfer, and also, of course, students' activities involved in these transferring pathways. So have you anticipated all of this before you conduct the study, or did you need to make any adjustment in the middle of the research?
The example or the set of examples that I just gave about measuring, accounting for, and harnessing data around educational intent was pretty carefully and well conceived prior to data collection. Because as a researcher who has pretty much spent all my time studying transfer, I was fully aware of all this muddiness, the good muddiness around intent. And then we have all different other terms to talk about that, right? So I was fully aware of these. So this was the good challenge that I sort of anticipated. And then I made sure that me and my team spent quite a bit of time in thinking prior to developing the research protocols and instruments in terms of our surveys and our interviews. So a large part of this was in our conceptualization. So that was done prior to the project. But during the project, as everything evolved, obviously there were ways in which the project was taking on an unexpected approach or direction that was not originally in my plan during the stage of conceptualizing the study. I'd be happy to share some of those examples if that's of interest.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, sure. Please go ahead. Yeah. What are some of the things like unexpectedly popped up? For example, or what are some of the changes you make that eventually lead to the findings of the study?
Right. Yeah, no, that's I just opened these doors, right?
Yes.
That's a very fair question, because although we can all go into a study with the best intentions and plans,
yeah,
all can agree that real authentic research rarely goes as planned. So there are definitely lots of adjustments that I made along the way. But in a sense, you know, looking back, they all added to the complexity and honesty of the study.
Right.
One example that came to mind was a pretty big picture one in terms of the research design in general. So I initially settled on a sequential quantitative toward qualitative mixed methods design. So sequential in nature, meaning that I started off with a quantitative phase as a pretty major phase with a lot of weight attached to it, and then linearly followed by qualitative approaches that were meant to support, further explain, and or triangulate findings from the quantitative strand. So in this sense, it's sequential quantitative qualitative mixed methods design. So this approach typically implied a priority given to the quantitative strand, and that was in my original thinking. However, due to the richness of the qualitative data we collected through the student interviews, I've realized it was no longer viable for student interviews and voices to only play a supportive role for the quantitative findings, but instead they deserved their full and undivided attention in our analysis in many cases. So I think this issue mirrors the highly iterative and interactive nature of this evolving mixed methods design, and actually mixed methods design in general. So the priority given to the quantitative or qualitative strands shifted over the course of my project. And in some cases, qualitative approaches, in fact, drove our subsequent efforts in analyzing and interpreting our quantitative findings. And in one case, qualitative analyses drove the design of our follow-up surveys by adding some additional survey items that were not originally in the picture. And then in some other cases, our quantitative approaches, of course, largely guided our survey data analysis and findings. At the same time, they would unravel some unique topics and directions very much suited for in-depth qualitative analyses that were not originally part of the qualitative component of our mixed methods design. So I think wrestling with being both largely faithful to the larger topic that I enter this project with, while understanding there's a highly emergent and fluid nature to the research design as an evolving tool that actually serves the larger topic, and being okay with the changes and adjustments made along the process in order to fully and honestly answer the large question. That was a very good journey for me to travel and to wrestle with. And finally, I think I came to terms with the fact that changing our research techniques, procedures, and processes do not necessarily take away from the larger topic that didn't change. And in a sense, it's really a reflection of honest adjustments. And so I learned to not to view that as a departure from where my heart was pointing toward.
Exactly. And as you know, I'm a qualitative methodologist, so I really applaud that the sensitivity you showed in the process of collecting and analyzing data about, you know, the qualitative data. So yeah, it's very interesting to hear the story. And I actually indeed noticed this when I was reading the book. I think it was very interesting to notice like how you pay attention to both trends and how you try to wrestle with both. And it's really good to know. And with that, I can't wait to enter into our discussion about the findings. In terms of the findings, the general question will be, will STEM transfer pathways help us in solving the problem of the shortage of STEM talents? What are some of the general takeaways from the research? I think we touched upon this a little bit, but it would be great if we could talk a little bit more.
Sure, absolutely. And that's such a great question. And as you probably have guessed, the answer is definitely not a binary yes, no answer to that question. And I think to answer this question fully, I need to unpack what I found a bit more. So I talk about the longitudinal design and then following students over the course of 4 years. 4 years later, the students fell under four trajectories, which I call momentum trajectories that I constructed based on the data. So only 40% of the students landed on the linear upward trajectory, meaning that they transferred to a four-year institution. And more alarmingly, about the same number and percentage of the students ended up on the taking a break trajectory, having left their two-year institution without transferring and without receiving any credential from their original two-year institution.
Wow. So I don't know if dropout is a good word to use, but it sounds like they drop out from their community college or like their original institutions.
In a sense, yes. So they were no, as of the close of the study 4 years later, our transcript records, and then coupled by the survey data, these students had no records in terms of ever transferring, or they have no records indicating they've ever received a post-secondary credential.
I see.
So then, and then the third trajectory, I found that 13% of the students were on the detoured trajectory, which means the students had to piece together multiple institutional attendance or programs in order to transfer upward. And oftentimes after recognizing that their initial institutional program was not a good fit. And then the final trajectory was called deferred, with 9% of the students on that one. Those students were initially determined to transfer, but had to let go of transfer to pursue a more short-term credential to make immediate returns to their education. So if we look at transfer as a simplistic measure of success, then these trajectories would suggest that not all students, quote unquote, succeeded. However, it is also important to point out that the students across all these four trajectories were remarkably motivated and resilient. They often held on to their high aspirations, strong sense of agency, and perseverance, which are sometimes also a very complex manifestation of their pre-existing tendencies of self-reliance and hesitance in seeking help. And this is especially true among many students of color and first-generation students. So this is the internal facet of On My Own, as embodied in my book title, and that represents the internal side of the key finding around On My Own. But there is an external level or facet to On My Own. Although students described positive experiences with individual advisors and instructors overall, they also at the same time ended up with limited intentional on-point institutional support that actually translated into a clear path toward transfer. So there were numerous external structural barriers and challenges on the part of both transfer sending and transfer receiving institutions alike. So some of these barriers and challenges included a lack of clear articulation in courses that applied to specific STEM majors. And there's a lack of clear course pathways that fit students' scheduling needs, especially in light of their life, work, family, and other obligations and responsibilities. And then a major barrier is the lack of financial support for transfer students. So altogether, my book reviews that these students were really pushing through these external side of on my own, these friction points eventually. They just kept pushing, but driven for the most part by their own internal on my own, which was their motivational momentum. This is really a testament of the remarkable talent these students are. But at the same time, we have to think about to fully realize the STEM transfer promise, the external on my own that I just described must be disrupted so that the internal on my own can become an asset if students needed it instead of these students' sole and only lifeline. So although, back to your question, although STEM transfer pathways have potential to resolve the so-called shortage in STEM talent, my findings really reveal there's a lot of work that remains to be done.
That's very, I mean, it's fascinating to hear that you have sorted out so carefully all the different contributing factors that may play the role of roadblocks, for example, for these students to transfer to a four-year college. But on the other hand, it also really makes us realize how important it is for, you know, the higher ed sector, for example, to work harder to support these students, as talented as they are, as motivated as they are, with the good support they will have a better chance to chase their dreams. With that, I really want to follow up with a question about stories, because the stories you shared in this book, it's a super powerful and super helpful in demonstrating this idea of on my own. And so I wonder, Shirley, would you like to share some of the stories here?
Yeah, I'd be very happy to. I was hugely privileged to get to study and learn from many transfer aspiring students through my study underlying this book. And so I want to take a moment to share maybe hopefully four brief stories of four remarkable individuals, each of them representing one of the four trajectories I just talked about. So first we have Katie, who was on the taking a break trajectory. Katie identified as a white woman, and she was a first generation student and a single mom of two. She was attending part-time with a goal to transfer into a science field one day. So her very first course was a general chemistry class, which Katie described as overwhelming. There was a lot of memorizing, and Katie was not good at that. To make things worse, due to her attention deficit disorder, she was in over her head with the lab, with all the noises, movements, and chemicals and such. And so Katie tried to discuss her struggles with the instructor once, and Katie described her instructor as kind and accommodating. But this conversation didn't actually go anywhere. The instructor reassured Katie, saying, "I feel like you're doing fine. Like, I don't feel concerned about your progress. I think you're doing okay." Katie never completed that chemistry class. Her leaving that conversation, still thinking the word of her instructor, but feeling like she would have to resolve all her own problems, really led to nowhere. Her flunking out of the class set in motion numerous failed attempts at possible academic paths over the next 4 years. And Katie was no longer enrolled at the college. She did not transfer, nor did she leave with any credentials. When I asked Katie to reflect on her time at the college, she said, "I have very much this sort of mentality, like I'm going to do it on my own. I'm going to bootstrap, do it the American way, all of that baloney. And now, as I'm reaching these precipices and making decisions about my future, I'm thinking, I can't make this decision on my own. I need more information. And next, we have Seamus, who was on the detoured trajectory. She identified as a multiracial.
I wonder, Shelly, I wonder if we could just take like a short moment of break before
sure.
we enter into this next story
sure.
to really ponder over Katie's story, because it has been so powerful to demonstrate the meaning of like on my own. And I feel like, oh, well, what could have been done to support her? Like, I feel like I need to ruminate on it a little bit more. It sounds like she had a bright dream of, you know, supporting her family, like developing her career. But what would have been done to help her realize the dream? Like you mentioned this class, and why this class is so important, was so important and set up the motion for her to, you know, divert from this pathway.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I unpacked Katie's story along with the story of many others throughout the book. And I think Katie's example illustrates several things. One is this pre-existing tendencies, especially among many first-generation students who were very motivated, who were very self-dependent, and assuming that, you know, they seeking help and fully articulating their needs and their struggles was not part of the picture. So like, for instance, Katie never really had anything negative to say about her instructor and her other experiences, advisors, instructors at the college she was attending, not even in the quote I just shared with you. She was really still describing the instructor as kind and accommodating. And I agree with her in terms of, I was talking about her tendencies as a first generation student, and of course, you know, suggesting some more reflective and intentional thinking and actions and practices toward better reaching out to and supporting first generation students to be critically important and missing this case. But also, I want to mention another element about Katie's story, that is what true accommodation really means. And I agree with Katie that the instructor was kind, meaning, well-intended. I didn't necessarily agree with the accommodating part, because out of his haste to hopefully support his student, in this case, Katie, the instructor actually well-intendedly dismissed Katie's opportunity to fully articulate her needs for support. Had the instructor waited to hear out more what Katie had to say, Katie's course might be taking a totally different turn. And we never knew. We never can just go back and rewrite Katie's story. But I kept wondering, what if he waited out? He waited one more minute or more to hear the complete story and the scenario from Katie. So I think this other larger issue that I mentioned is really on the instructors and on institutional actors, frankly, you know, advisors, instructors, and sometimes out of our well-intended ways to support the students, we actually shut the opportunities to fully get to understand the full person. And we were having a hard time to reflectively balance challenge and support and reassurance. And so this obviously pertains to supporting students like Katie, who is first generation, who struggles with learning disabilities and some mental health issues she also reviewed. But this also translates into other minoritized groups of students whom we work with, but oftentimes with a lot of assumptions that we didn't even know that we had that weren't quite helpful.
Well, thank you so much for reflecting upon this case, this story with us together. And what you have just said really makes me think about, you know, the role of institutional players, or like the institutional actors, for example, like the instructors in this case. And I believe like some other, you know, institutional actors, like, I don't know, I mean, like their academic advisors and some of like other administrators, they could all, you know, it sounds like it's a collective effort, and it takes a village to support transferring student. Well, with that, let's move to the next story.
Yeah, I was going to share the story of Seamus, who was on the detour trajectory. Seamus identified as a multiracial Black woman, and she was in her early 20s when she started in her two-year college's biotech program that prepares students for both jobs and transfer as per their website description of their mission. A few years back, Seamus began college actually as a freshman at the flagship university's College of Engineering, and she was on a competitive scholarship program that was meant to attract academically talented women and students from groups historically underrepresented in the field of engineering. So that was the program description of her scholarship. So advising, when Seamus was at the university's School of Engineering, advising was sorely missing during her first year. So Seamus flunked out of the university and enrolled in her current two-year college and hoping to